I listened to Dion's sermon a couple of weeks ago when he talked about the vision. Joel mentioned it earlier, and there's a few things that really resonated with me. And this phrase that came to me when I was thinking about some of those goals, not all of them, but some of them, and it was standing by the door. And so that's going to be driving what I'm talking about for the next couple of weeks while he's out, and we'll get back to it, and we'll it'll make sense in a little bit. If you could turn your Bibles to John chapter 4, it's a classic story. It's got a little intrigue, some scandal. It's a centuries old conflict with some deep seated racial tension. Sins are exposed. A good boy from the country meets a bad girl from town. Kind of sounds like a bad made-for-TV movie, but that's really where we start. So let's go. John chapter 4, starting in verse 3. When the Lord learned of this, he left Judea and went back once more to Galilee. Now he had to go through Samaria. So he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given his son Joseph. So the first thing about the story is to set the stage for the people who live here. This is inhabited by the Samaritans. So the Samaritans, when the Jews were carried off by the Assyrian and Babylonian exiles, the way people used to get rid of nations in conflict, instead of killing everyone, which sometimes they did that too, what they would do is they would carry off a whole lot of people, anybody who had skills, education, anybody they could find a use for as a slave, they would take them with them, and then they would spread them around the rest of their empire. And then they would take people from other places they had conquered, and they would bring them to the place they just destroyed. The hope was that these scattered peoples would intermarry. They would lose their religion, their culture, their language, their national identity. And all they would have left is the cultural identity of the conquering nation. It was really effective. A whole lot of nations that used to exist don't anymore, and this is a big reason why. The Samaritans are the folks who, when the Assyrians and the Babylonians carried off the rest of the Jews, these are the people who were left behind. They're the ones who were less desirable as slaves. So over time, they did intermarry some, but they did cling to their identity as Jews. Maybe not the way other Jews wanted them to, but they did cling to it. So when the Jews returned from exile, hundreds of years later, well, about 100 years later, 70 years later, they found the Samaritans living there. And they wanted to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. The Samaritans offered to help. And I don't know exactly what motivated the help. If you read the text in the Old Testament, there's a lot of animosity between them, but they said, no, we don't want you to because you're not pure. You're half-breeds. You're going to inhibit us from getting the promises of God because you didn't stay pure. That obviously didn't go over well with the Samaritans. So a lot has happened since then, and we'll cover a little bit more. The bottom line, though, is that a good Jew hated the Samaritan so much by this point, he wouldn't travel through there on a straight line. It would be like if you were going to drive to Chicago. You hate the people of Indiana so much that you don't want your tires to get dirty on their roads. So instead of driving straight there in an 8-hour drive or so, you're going to drive down to Kentucky, cut through the state of Kentucky. It's a great drive, by the way. Drive through there and then come up north through Illinois. You're going to triple your distance and your time just because you hate the people there so much. That's how folks viewed the Samaritans. Jesus doesn't. He takes a straight line and goes right through. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about the sixth hour. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" His disciples had gone into town to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "You are a Jew, and I'm a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews do not associate with Samaritans. So we've talked about this some already. A good Jew wouldn't talk to a Samaritan. One of the things that really, the tension between these two peoples had gotten violent. So in response to the Samaritans not being allowed to worship in Jerusalem, be part of the temple there, what they'd done is they'd built their own temple. And they'd built it 100 or so years before this. The Jews at one point said, again, to try to make their nation pure, what we're gonna do is we're gonna destroy it. There's only one temple, there's not two. So they went up and destroyed the temple, attacked them, killed some people, destroyed the temple. Again, didn't go over well with the people there. They had at times tried to attack the temple in Jerusalem and attack pilgrims on their way there for Passover. They didn't have the military power and might that some of the Jews had during the Jewish independence, but the conflict had turned violent. In addition to that, a good Jewish man wouldn't speak to a woman that he didn't know. A good Jewish man in the culture of the time would only speak to his wife, his mom, sisters, daughter. That's about it. Some Jewish men said even that was too much and that you shouldn't speak to women almost ever. We'll just leave that one. and the last one is a good Jewish rabbi wouldn't associate with a person who was a sinner. John says in this text that this happened around the sixth hour. That's about noon. So around the hottest part of the day. This woman came at the worst time of day to come to draw water. Typically in a small village or a town, women would go draw water. They would be the ones who went. And they would either go early in the morning or they'd go in the evening when it was cooler. And they would also go as a group. Safer, but it was also a time for them to get out of the house, to get away from the chores of, and to talk. And to, that would be a center. Doesn't sound exciting, but that would be a center of social life. This woman avoids all that. Goes alone when no one else will be around. So Jesus, in talking to her, he breaks a lot of social taboos and he risks his reputation. In some ways, it might even be viewed as forward of him to speak to this woman in this way. Almost, she might interpret it this way. She might almost interpret it like if today someone said, hey, so you come here often to wait to start up a conversation. It was a forward thing for him to do. If we keep reading in the text. So Jesus answered her, if you knew the gift of God and who it was that asked you for a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water. Sir, the woman said, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did also his sons and his flocks and his herds? Jesus answered, everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks the water I give him will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life. The woman said to him, sir, give me this water, so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water. This well, by the way, it's still there from what I understand, and it's about 100 feet deep. It was probably deeper then. So this woman's understanding of living water, and I don't know that I want to get into it a whole lot, but there's certainly a theological issue that he's talking about. She's talking about a physical thing like water in a stream, not in a cistern or a well. But there was this idea, and it comes from Numbers, when the people of Israel were blessed by Balaam, and one of the things he says is that his buckets will be running over with water, and it's a prophecy that that the Samaritans attached to the Messiah, and so Jesus is kind of picking on something from her background. And pulling it in. So keep going in the text in verse 16. He told her, go call your husband and come back. I have no husband, she replied. Jesus said to her, you're right when you say you have no husband. The fact is,
You've had five husbands.
And the man you now have is not your husband. What you have said is true. So if she had any idea that he was being forward with her now, I think at this point it probably ends for her. Where she realizes, if she thought maybe this is number six, she's probably not thinking that anymore. I can't imagine exactly what her face probably looked like when that was exposed. My guess is she came here at this time so nobody would say something like this to her. So no one would bring up her past and her current situation. What amazes me about this woman, I mean, to me, she seems like she must have been pretty sharp, pretty quick on her feet. She responds pretty fast. "Sir," the woman said, "I can see you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem." Jesus declared, "Believe me, woman, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you don't know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming and has now come when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshipers must worship in spirit and truth." What amazes me about her is how fast she turns the conversation. And how she turns it to what? When the heat rises on her and her sin is exposed, she flips it to something that we can argue about. This conflict between your people and my people that's led to violence, it's so deep-seated, I can dismiss you entirely. We can end this conversation in a shouting match or just walk away by bringing this up. I know we've never argued about worship, right? That never happens. It's a quick way to shut this whole thing down. The woman then says, after Jesus brings up this other comment, "I know that the Messiah, called Christ, is coming. When he comes, he will explain everything to us." And then Jesus declared, "I who speak to you am he." So the Samaritans, they had a very different view of the Messiah than the Jews did. The Jews held this idea that they were going to get a king like King David, a conquering hero who was going to wipe out all their enemies and create this dynasty of power and wealth and military might. Samaritans didn't have that view. They only had the first five books of the Old Testament. They rejected everything after that. All the prophets, all the history books, Psalms, Proverbs, they ignored all that. Just the first five books of Moses. And so their view of the Messiah, who's first prophesied by Moses to come, is that they'll get someone who's like him, a lawgiver, a teacher, a spiritual leader, more so than a military ruler. So in a lot of ways, the Samaritan view of the Messiah to come was more accurate than what many Jews held. And so Jesus, of all the people that he could talk to, the first one in the Gospel of John he identifies as, he tells, "I am the Messiah." It's this Samaritan woman. Back in verse 27, "Just then his disciples returned, and they were surprised to find him talking with a woman. But no one asked, 'What do you want?' or 'Why are you talking with her?'" I just love that about those guys. Jesus just messes with them, and they don't even ask anymore. "Then leaving her water jar," that's the whole reason she came. "Leaving her water jar, the woman went back to town and said to the people, 'Come and see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Christ?' They came out of the town and made their way toward him. Again, this woman just amazes me. Minutes before, she was avoiding everyone in town. I can't imagine she made eye contact with people as she went with her water jar down the street. And now she's running up to them, grabbing them, talking to them, excited. And even embracing, he told me what I did. So it's not like she's running away from what he said. And what's so impressive about this story is that Jesus didn't really do anything remarkable like we're used to in the Gospels, right? There were no miracles here. He didn't heal anyone. He didn't raise anyone from the dead. He didn't jump down into the well 100 feet and then jump back out. He didn't call water out of a rock. He didn't calm a storm, nothing. He just talked to her. Something that I'm guessing not a lot of men did with her. Certainly not Jewish rabbis. So here at the end of this little section of scripture, many of the Samaritans from that town believed in him because of the woman's testimony. He told me everything I ever did. So when the Samaritans came to him, they urged him to stay with them, and he stayed 2 days. And because of his words, many more became believers. They said to the woman, "We no longer believe just because of what you said. Now we've heard for ourselves, and we know that this man really is the Savior of the world." Her message was very simple. This is what happened when I met Jesus. She didn't go into this big theological discussion. She didn't bring out this whole discourse on what living water is. She didn't go through the worship issues with where we do it, where they do it, or talk about what Bible we should use and what's in the canon or not. She just told people what happened when she met Jesus. It's a story that no one can argue with. And she's one of the most effective evangelists in the Bible. I really like the fact that it says the people believed because of her first. They then confirmed it by their own experience, but she's the one who got them to believe. How many people are in heaven today because of this woman? A whole town? How many generations after that? I think there's two reasons why this is in the Bible. The first one is God sees all of us as his children. He doesn't want there to be any racial or economic or social or ethnic barriers that hold us back from each other or from the kingdom. So Jesus broke through all those barriers and he reached across this ethnic tension that was filled with violence over centuries. And when I think about that, I can't help but think that in our country, in so many ways, I think we're better off on race relations than we were when I was born. When I talk to people who are my parents' age and older, I know that's true because I mean, just before I was born, segregation was still legal. But we have a long way to go. I can't go onto a news site today, on any day, and not find headline after headline about racial tensions in America and about the violence that's coming from it. I don't know how we're going to fix race relations in America. I don't for a second believe anyone in Washington or in Columbus is going to do it for us. I have no faith in them. For that, anyway. If there is any place where race shouldn't matter, it's here. If there's any group in America that should lead the charge in bringing about healing and reconciliation, it's the church. I'm not going to look to anyone who runs for office of any kind from any party to do that. I don't care what color you are, what language you speak, where you were born, what city you live in, what car you drive, how much money you have, or what your job is, you're welcome here. People need to meet Jesus, and it's our job, like the Samaritan woman, to make that introduction happen. The second reason I think this story is in the Bible is to tell us that there's no one who's beyond the reach of Jesus. We can't give up on anyone ever, no matter how unlikely that person may look. God can change anyone's heart. We can never think that a situation is too unfavorable, a person too hopeless, or a heart too hard for God to reach through. This woman was the most unlikely person in the Gospel of John to even respond to Jesus. And she becomes one of the best evangelists in the entire Bible. So let's come back to that phrase that I have been thinking about for a few weeks now, standing by the door. My favorite poem, and admittedly, I'm not really that into poetry. My favorite poem is written by a guy named Sam Shoemaker. He's an Episcopal priest. If you're familiar with Alcoholics Anonymous, you may have heard of him. If you are familiar with AA and you haven't heard of him, you are familiar with his teachings, because the majority, or at least a large portion, of the biblical principles behind AA came from Sam and his interactions with Bill Wilson, one of the co-founders. And so I want to read that for you. I stand by the door. I neither go too far in nor stay too far out. The door is the most important door in the world. It's the door through which men walk when they find God. There's no use my going way inside and staying there when so many are still outside, and they, as much as I, crave to know where the door is. And all that so many ever find is only the wall where the door ought to be. They creep along the wall like blind men with outstretched groping hands, feeling for a door, knowing there must be a door, yet they never find it. So I stand by the door. The most tremendous thing in the world is for men to find that door, the door to God. The most important thing that any man can do is to take hold of one of those blind, groping hands and put it on the latch. The latch that only clicks and opens to the man's own touch. Men die outside that door, as starving beggars die on cold nights in cruel cities in the dead of winter, die for want of what is within their grasp. They live on the other side of it, live because they have not found it. Nothing else matters compared to helping him find it and open it and walk in and find him. So I stand by the door. Go in, great saints, go all the way in. Go way down into cavernous cellars, way up into spacious attics. It's a vast, roomy house, this house where God is. Go into the deepest of hidden casements, of withdrawal, of silence, of sainthood. Some must inhabit those inner rooms and know the depths and the heights of God and call out to the rest of us how wonderful it is. Sometimes I take a deeper look in, sometimes venture in a little further, but my place seems closer to the opening, so I stand by the door. There's another reason why I stand there. Some people get partway in and become afraid, lest God and zeal of his house devour them, for God is so very great, and ask all of us. And these people feel a cosmic claustrophobia and want to get out. Let me out, they cry. And the people way inside only terrify them more. Somebody must be by the door to tell them that they are spoiled for the old life. They've seen too much. One taste of God and nothing but God will do anymore. Somebody must be watching for the frightened who seek to sneak out just where they came in, to tell them how much better it is inside. The people too far in do not see how near these are to leaving, preoccupied with the wonder of it all. Somebody must watch for those who have entered the door but would like to run away. So for them too, I stand by the door. I admire the people who go way in, but I wish they would not forget how it was before they got in. Then they would be able to help the people who have not yet found even the door. For the people who want to run away again from God, you can go in too deeply and stay in too long and forget the people outside the door. As for me, I shall take my old accustomed place, near enough to God to hear him and know he is there, but not so far from men as to not hear them and remember they are there too. Outside the door, thousands of them, millions of them. But more important for me, one of them, two of them, 10 of them, whose hands I am intended to put on the latch. So I shall stand by the door and wait for those who seek it. I had rather be a doorkeeper. So I stand by the door. If there's something that you want us to be praying with you about, if you're on the wall and you're grasping for the latch, you can come up now. Some of the elders will come up and we're going to sing another song. If there's something else you want us to be praying about, we will do that as well. If we could stand now as we sing.